there, you're listening to the My Sleeping Baby podcast, which is all about baby and child sleep. I'm so excited to teach you how you can get your little one sleeping so that you can sleep too and enjoy parenthood to its fullest. I'm Eva Klein, your resident sleep expert, mom of three, founder of the Sleep Bible online coaching program, and lover of all things sleep and motherhood. If you're looking for tangible solutions for your little one's sleep woes, or you simply want to learn more, this podcast is for you. For more information, check out mysleepingbaby.com, and you can follow me on Instagram and Facebook at mysleepingbaby. All right, Kara, thank you so much for being here today on the My Sleeping Baby podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amazing. So before we dive in, why don't you tell everyone a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Yes, definitely. So I am a child psychologist with a PhD and a mother to three kids. And when I became a mother myself, I realized that there was a real problem with, you know, there's all this research out there on parenting and child development, but it's not really reaching the parents who need it. So my goal, I started three years ago now, Parenting Translator, which is a nonprofit organization, with the goal of taking all the research that's out there on parenting, child development, basically any question that's relevant for parents, and translating it into information that parents can use to make the hardest job in the world, like maybe a tiny bit easier. Mm-hmm.
I love that. No, and one of the many reasons why I'm so excited for this interview is because, you know, the internet for moms, I feel like, is this double-edged sword, right? Where on the one hand, it's so wonderful to have access to so much information out there. But on the other hand, it can be really challenging to differentiate between what is someone's opinion, right, versus what is actually based in fact. You know, do I do this versus do I do that? Well, I read a blog article telling me that I shouldn't be doing, you know, X, Y, Z. Well, is that blog article based on someone's opinion or is it based on, you know, actual data? And there's no shortage of opinions out there, right? Yeah. That's the thing. But I feel like what there is a shortage of is people like you who might have opinions, but the opinions are based on what the data is actually showing, what the research is actually showing versus, you know, what they just feel deep down inside. And listen, everyone has a right to their opinion, but it doesn't necessarily mean that your opinion is based on fact, right? Or based on evidence, right? So that's why I'm really excited to have you here today to specifically talk about what the research says on some really important topics. So the three hot button topics I want to talk about today are number one, pacifiers, number two, addressing bedtime fears with our little ones, and number three, screen time. So we're going to talk about, you know, the babies, the toddlers, the preschoolers. We're going to cover you know, the whole gamut here. So let's first talk about the use of pacifiers here. So, and specifically the question of whether or not they can interfere with breastfeeding and when a pacifier should be introduced, because I know that there is a whole range of opinion and messaging out there around the use of pacifiers. As a mom, I heard the whole gamut of messaging myself. So I would love for you to take a deep dive into what the research actually says.
Yes. So this is one of the questions that we actually have like a really clear research answer for. So there have been a lot of very high quality studies. So the highest quality study is called a randomized controlled trial. And that basically means you just randomly assign some mothers to using pacifiers from birth and some to avoid pacifiers. And so these studies have found that there is no link between starting pacifiers at birth and any difficulties with breastfeeding or breastfeeding for not as long. So we really have no evidence that pacifiers starting from birth get in the way of breastfeeding. And it really is a myth that you need to wait until breastfeeding is established. And this is a great example of research not reaching the people who need it, because I think I know I heard this as a new mom. A lot of moms still hear this from, you know, pediatricians, blogs, whatever it is. Wait until breastfeeding is established before using a pacifier because of the potential issues with breastfeeding. And for those of us who really care about breastfeeding, you know, that's hard to hear. But yeah, the research is pretty clear. There's no link between starting pacifiers, even from birth, and later breastfeeding problems.
So where do you feel like this myth comes from? Is it maybe because the evidence around introducing a bottle is a little bit different? Because that's what I have heard, is that, you know, the guidelines and recommendations and the research around introducing a bottle when breastfeeding is not established is a little bit different. So maybe can you talk briefly about that? And then I guess the second question is it possible that the pacifier got lumped in with the bottle? With these recommendations?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of, since the real push for breastfeeding and the research that has come out showing some of the benefits that are linked with breastfeeding, I think there's been a real push to be, do everything to preserve the breastfeeding relationship. But, you know, we also need to acknowledge what is realistic, particularly in the US, where we don't have a lot of support for new mothers. And, you know, mothers need tools to use. So I think a lot of it was like, let's be very careful about breastfeeding. The research on bottles is a little bit less clear, but we don't really have strong evidence either way. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that we have such strong evidence that you should never use a bottle before breastfeeding is established. I wouldn't say it's at that point. Mm-hmm. I think the myth comes from wanting to preserve that breastfeeding relationship, but a lot of these suggestions that are out there don't really acknowledge the realities of being a new mother. And, mm-hmm. you know, if the pacifier is going to get you some sleep, and there's no evidence that it hurts breastfeeding, then you should use that.
100%. Yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, and I'm so happy that, you know, we're talking about this, because the reality is that for newborns in particular, the pacifier is such a helpful sleep tool, because newborns are born with a very well-known sucking reflex, right? It's one of the famous five S's to help calm your newborn's little nervous system. And offering them a pacifier, offering them something to suck on, can really help them calm down. And it means, practically speaking, that if you are nursing your brand newborn baby a million times a day, the pacifier can give you a bit of a break, which is huge for your mental health. On top of that, from a sheer sleep standpoint, it can make putting your little one, you know, into their bassinet or their crib, either awake or drowsy, but awake, so much easier. Like it can make getting your little one to sleep so much easier, because it means that they've got something to suck on, you know, allowing their nervous system to calm down and relax, making it easier for them to then be able to fall asleep. Versus if your little one only relies on, you know, nursing to sleep as a means of, you know, activating that calming reflex, it's going to end up being a lot more challenging to then unlatch that baby, get them out of your arms and, you know, and into their own space. There's just so much more involved with that transfer, which practically speaking increases the likelihood of the baby waking up and then you having to start all over again. And then it just ends up being so much more stressful. Like the pacifier just makes life as a mom with a newborn so much easier, period. That is first and foremost. And, what I always heard was that as long as you don't use the pacifier as a means of replacing the need for a feed or, you know, or majorly pushing off the feed, then it really shouldn't get in the way of breastfeeding. Is that advice that you would give, you know, just to sort of give more context here?
Yes. Yes. I think it's important to mention, yeah, you do not want to skip feeds. The way you build up your breast milk supply is the more frequently your breasts are fully emptied, mm-hmm. the more milk you have, you know, it's supply and demand. So if you feel like your baby isn't getting enough, you feel like your supply is going down, you feel like, they are, you know, not feeding as frequently as they should, they're not gaining weight, then that's when you want to, you know, do those, you can do scheduled feeds, like, you know, make sure you feed every 2 hours, obviously discuss this with your pediatrician or your lactation consultant in detail. Mm-hmm. But you can still use the pacifier. You know, it's all about the frequency of feeding. It's not about whether they are using the pacifier specifically, you know, but if right. even if you're feeding every 2 hours, they could use the pacifier in between so that you could get a little bit of a break.
Right, right, right. And I'll just go so far to say, and of course, this is an opinion, you know, speaking of opinions versus, you know, facts, what I'm about to say is obviously, you know, not based on any data that I'm aware of, but something that I've, you know, always as a mom myself who has breastfed and, you know, who has worked with thousands of moms, you know, many of whom have breastfed as well. I can't help but, you know, really think that when a mom has a tool like a pacifier to be able to give her a bit of a break, I do truly believe that that will indirectly help breastfeeding in the grand scheme of things. And again, I want to emphasize that I don't have a study to be able to link here. I'm just, you know, just basically spewing what my thoughts are. But I'm so curious to see if there ends up being some research, you know, backing up like what this gut feeling of mine says, yes, which is that,
Yeah. I was just going to say postpartum depression is linked to breastfeeding difficulties. There's a lot of studies showing that. And you know, your mental health matters, period, as a mother, but like also your mental health will impact your child. It will impact your breastfeeding. So make sure you're taking care of your mental health. And like,
yes,
you know, for example, with my third child, he would scream every time he was in the car. And like, it was devastating to me, you know, because he had to be in the car all the time. It took me some work getting him to take the pacifier, but eventually once he had the pacifier in the car, he wasn't screaming. I could drive calmly, you know, that kind of quality of life stuff like really matters as a mother.
Yeah, totally. You know, and so I feel like this, you know, advice, like what you were saying, you know, that there's this, you know, push to breastfeed for better or for worse. I don't want to delve in specifically to that. I mean, I guess that's a separate topic of conversation that we could probably delve into as like a separate point, but you know, for better or for worse, there's this push to breastfeed. You know, lactation consultants might not want to risk the breastfeeding relationship, even one little tiny iota. So, you know, to protect the breastfeeding relationship, they'll just say, well, you shouldn't use a pacifier because there might be a teeny tiny risk that breastfeeding can be, you know, impacted, not recognizing that that advice might actually be counterproductive to their goal. Because when a mom is not giving a pacifier and she doesn't have any other tools to be able to, you know, help calm her fussy baby, and then breastfeeding just feels so unbelievably overwhelming, she might then say, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to switch to bottles, which again, for the record, there's no problem with bottle feeding here. Like you can absolutely, you know, feed your baby bottles guilt-free, but I'm talking specifically in the context of, you know, a mom who wants to breastfeed, you know, for longer, she might get burnt out so much more quickly when she doesn't have a tool like a pacifier to be able to calm her baby, because then it basically just turns her into a human pacifier, which is beyond exhausting, is going to absolutely impact maternal mental health, and could directly lead to her saying, you know what, this breastfeeding is too hard. I need a break. I need to start introducing bottles because this is just too hard for me. So, yeah, you know, we'll see like what kind of research ends up coming about, you know, later on, but that's sort of always been my gut feeling around this, you know, taking a harsh, you know, no pacifier approach to this sort of thing, is that I feel like it's misguided and it's actually probably counterproductive as well. But again, just my opinion.
Yes. Yeah, I completely agree. Yes. I think we need to acknowledge the realities of motherhood and not just, you know, how it would go in an ideal world. You know, that's just not helpful to people.
Yeah. And I would even go so far as to say that, you know, this probably also applies to introducing, let's say, one daily bottle, right? Again, I know that bottles and pacifiers are technically separate things, but, you know, I remember when my second baby was a newborn and she was, I don't know, 2-3 weeks old, and she was cluster feeding literally every 90 minutes, you know, just nursing all day long. And so for the purposes of giving myself a break and being able to get a proper stretch of sleep, what I started doing immediately, which is one of the biggest pieces of advice that I give in my newborn sleep program, is I handed the baby and a bottle off to my husband. I would feed the baby, hand the baby off to my husband with a bottle, go to sleep. My husband would then do the next feed with a bottle. And then it meant that by the time she would wake up again, I would have been able to get like a 5 to 6 hour, you know, stretch of sleep. And so I was sharing this information with an acquaintance of mine at the time who was a lactation consultant. And she looked at me and she said, "Oh, Eva, be careful." I said, "What do you mean, be careful?" She goes, "Well, you know, you don't want that bottle can get in the way of breastfeeding." And I remember looking at her and rolling my eyes and saying to her, like, this baby is nursing 25,000 times a day. If this one bottle is going to get in the way of breastfeeding, I said, there's no way that that's going to happen. There's no way. Like, I'm using my common sense here. That doesn't make sense. And I pushed back on her. And I said to her, I said, I would even argue that this bottle that allows me to sleep a 5 to 6 hour stretch is enabling the breastfeeding to continue, because it's giving me the energy that I need to then be able to go back and nurse her every 2 to 3 hours after I've had that stretch. So I said, be careful of the kind of advice that you're giving moms, because that if I were to apply your advice literally, I'd probably give up on breastfeeding a lot sooner, because I'd probably be so burnt out and exhausted. She didn't know what to say. She changed the topic.
Yeah, I have a whole newsletter on this, because I feel very, very strongly too that, you know, a lot of the things we tell mothers about breastfeeding and about sleep are very unrealistic and not based in research. And they seem to be a lot instead based on shaming mothers. And, you know, I think.
And philosophy. I feel like a lot of it is like philosophy.
It's very hard to have a newborn, and we need to only be making it more difficult if we have like a very strong research evidence that it's important, right?
Yeah. It shouldn't be philosophy, you know, driven. Yeah. Like, well, I breastfeed, so therefore, and I go into, I'm putting myself into this tribe. And therefore in this tribe, you know, this is what they do. Like screw that.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Do what works. Like, this is hard. This is hard. Don't put yourself in a camp. Oh, this tribalism. It's very harmful in the grand scheme of things. I'm not a fan.
Yes, I completely agree.
Okay. All right. So I'm so glad that we covered that one. So let's now shift gears and talk specifically about the best way to approach fears in our little ones. And I want to specifically focus on bedtime fears, because, you know, the scaries, being afraid of, you know, being afraid of being alone in your bed or crib at night, you know, this is a really common pain point of a lot of parents that I work with, of, you know, even like older babies, toddlers, preschoolers. So, you know, I would love to delve into this one in more detail. So before we actually talk about the, you know, the how-to of this, how to address these fears head on. From what you have seen, what is the earliest age that, you know, a baby or a toddler can legitimately develop fears around something?
Yes. So it usually happens between around 2 to 4. It's funny because my 2-year-old kind of just developed it. And he's a little bit on the early side, I think, because he has older siblings, but usually around 2 to 4. And it's interesting because they kind of just come out of nowhere, you know, as a parent, and you're like, wait, where did that come from? All of a sudden they're scared of the dark. But, you know, most babies sleep in the pitch black room. They don't care. And then all of a sudden one day they're scared of the dark.
Right.
So these are extremely common. And it often occurs when parents feel like they finally have gotten sleep figured out, and then all of a sudden the fears come up. But the good news is that there are ways to address these fears. And you know, it's very important to remember that it's very common and that nearly every parent deals with this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so what would you say is the best framework for parents to be following when suddenly their 2-year-old is going, "Mommy, I'm scared. You know, I don't want to go into my room by myself. I don't want to be, you know," suddenly all of a sudden they don't want to fall asleep by themselves. They're afraid of this or afraid of that. And they just don't want to be alone.
Yeah. So the first thing you want to do is make sure you validate this fears. You know, I think it's very easy for us as parents to be like, "Oh no, there are no monsters." Like, no, that's just pretend. But so you want to validate, just say, "I understand, you know, it's a big room. It's really dark. Like, I understand that you're scared." But then the next piece is, after validating, you want to quickly kind of move into problem solving. You know, we don't want to dwell in that validation mm-hmm. stage too long. So the way to problem solve this with your kids is to help them to kind of very gently and gradually face their fears. So if you change the environment so much that they never have to face those fears, then the anxiety actually increases, you know? So we want to make sure we are very gently kind of encouraging our kids to face those fears. So, mm-hmm. you know, breaking it down into steps and figuring out what is the easiest way or what is like the easiest first thing to try. You know, if they're scared of a pitch black room, it doesn't mean you have to turn on all their lights every night. Just be, you know, start with like one light and then make it progressively darker.
Right.
Work with them on strategies for helping them to feel calm, you know, whether it's deep breathing, whether maybe they're listening to, you know, some music. A lot of night lights play music. Maybe, you know, it's, there's a really great study, that I thought was such a cute idea was, they gave young children stuffed animals and said that the teddy bear is afraid of the dark. Can you take care of him and make sure he's safe overnight? And it actually really decreased the kids' fears, which is so interesting. And such a,
like, they're being empowered.
Yeah. They were being empowered. They kind of saw themselves in like the comforter role, and in comforting the teddy bear, they actually comforted themselves too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like a strategy that I really love is, you know, think about like a lovey or a teddy bear that they could be like, you have to make them feel better. You know, it's kind of like walking this fine line between validating, acknowledging, helping them through this, but also like pushing them a little bit.
Yeah.
And making sure you're like praising and rewarding each step along the way.
Right. Because I feel like a lot of parents in that situation will go, "Well, oh my gosh, my kid is too scared to go to sleep by herself. So I guess I now just have to sit in the room until she falls asleep, because otherwise she's scared and she'll cry and then she won't go to sleep."
Yeah.
So when a parent tells you that, you know, I've been sitting in my kid's room for, you know, X number of days or weeks until they fall asleep because they're too scared to be alone.
Yes. Yeah. And a gradual way to deal with that, like a very common issue is, you know, I know I did this with my oldest is, you know, we were laying down with her until she fell asleep. And then, you know, then when we had more kids, we're like, we can't keep doing this.
Yeah.
And so we went from laying down with her until she fell asleep to sitting in a chair right by the bed, to sitting in a chair away from the bed, to sitting in a chair outside the room with the door open, to sitting in a chair outside the room with the door closed, you know, like take baby steps. Cause that's going to be so much easier than, you know, just locking them in their room and being like, "Good luck.
100%.
I'll see you in the morning."
Right.
So, and there's, another great one for children who's more based in separation anxiety is there's some research on something called the bedtime pass, which mm-hmm. is the idea that you give them like a little pass. It can be anything, you know, just a piece of paper that you made, and they're allowed to come out of their room once,
okay,
you know, to get another hug, kiss, to get a drink of water, you know, what they have lots mm-hmm. of eat at bedtime. So, so this is good for kids who are constantly coming out of their room.
Right.
They're allowed to come out of their room once with the mm-hmm. bedtime pass. And when they do, then you take the bedtime pass. If they don't come out of their room at all, they can trade in the bedtime pass for a reward in the morning.
Okay.
So that's another like research-backed kind of hack that parents can use if you
Right.
the kid is constantly coming out of the room.
Yeah. And that's probably a great strategy for the kids who, you know, unlike your daughter, where you said that you were sort of always lying next to her until she fell asleep. So that just sort of became her regular routine. But for the kids who have been falling asleep by themselves and suddenly are going through, you know, a phase where they're scared and they don't want to be alone, to, you know, instead of going back and sort of, instead of taking a couple steps back and sitting in their room until they fall asleep, using that bedtime pass strategy can be a really great way for them to continue to be able to fall asleep on their own, but with some extra support from their parents at bedtime, right?
Yes, exactly.
Is that the type of approach that you would recommend specifically for parents in that situation who are going, I sleep trained my kid when she was 6 months. She's been going to sleep completely on her own since then. And she suddenly turned 2 or 2.5 or 3 years old and, you know, and then won't let me leave the room now.
Yes. Yeah. I would suggest the, having it be a gradual approach. You know, the bedtime pass is only one they can use if they're in their own bed and are actually coming out. You know, I think having a gradual approach, the checking in method is always good. You know, I think it's useful if parents like tell their kids what they're going to do, you know, cause, I would tell, we all have a lot to do at night. So I'm like,
yeah,
I'm going to go load the dishwasher. I'm going to come right back, you know, and eventually in the waiting, they will fall asleep without you there and they'll realize they can, you know?
Yeah.
Just think about things you have to do. If you kind of need like a reason to leave, you know, just think, okay, I'm going to go let the dogs outside and then I'll come right back up.
Mm-hmm.
And just like progressively longer and longer intervals. If they're like absolutely losing their mind when you try to leave.
Right. And is it that when they go through the motions of falling asleep by themselves, you know, in their room, whether it's a crib or a bed, you know, as you're checking on them, like you said, you know, they'll fall asleep with at some point within that interval. Is the key here that they then learn through experience that falling asleep on their own in their room is actually not so scary after all?
Yeah, I think they help, it helps them to face their fears and it helps them kind of build the confidence. So it's just really like encouraging your kids to like very gently and gradually face their fears. And that really creates resilience in them too for challenges they're going to face later.
Right. So, you know, in other words, our job as parents is not to make sure that our kids are happy, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yes.
That's
Exactly. And something else with older kids, a benefit is that you can explain this to them, you know, you can explain to them, I really need you to fall asleep on your own because at night, you know, even if you're just going to watch Netflix, like, you know, just explain to them, like, I really need downtime. You know, mommy needs that in order to be a good mommy tomorrow. And, when I sit with you, you know, it takes a lot of my night and I really need that time for me. So explain it to them. I think you'll be surprised by how even young children can understand. Just make sure when you're presenting it to them that you're presenting it as, this is our new plan, you know, not like, you know, up for negotiation. Cause I think they will always choose for you to be in their room until they fall asleep.
Yeah.
You know, well, most kids will. So just make sure you like explain to them the rationale, the new plan. And I think a lot of kids, when you explain them the rationale, will get it and understand. And you know, you can say, I'm going to be here to help you with this. We're going to figure this out together. You know, you can be supportive and emotionally validating and also push your kids a little bit.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, recognize that you as the parents, as the adults, can see the big picture here in terms of why these new routines, these boundaries are so important that your 2-year-old, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 5-year-old just doesn't have the ability to see and understand, right? And, you know, and that's why kids need parents, right? Kids need guardians. They need us. And I think, you know, from a much bigger standpoint, you know, the point here, which is that, yes, the child might be upset at first with this new boundary or the boundary being enforced, you know, recognizing that if they are upset about it, it does not mean that we're failing our kids, right? And I think that a lot of us need that reminder because I think so many of us in our generation were raised in a more authoritarian type of household, which we know is not ideal, you know, whatsoever for raising, you know, happy, healthy, emotionally stable children. And so the end result is that many of us sort of instinctively want to swing the pendulum to like the opposite end of the spectrum, where, you know, it's too much in the other direction, right? So I feel like this is a really important reminder that that healthy, loving boundaries are not just okay, but they're not just allowed, but it's actually good for your kid, you know, to be told no sometimes, right? To, as you said, to be able to build that resilience.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I think it's all about balance. Like we do need that emotional validating, the supporting our kids, but we also need to push them a little bit.
Okay. No, this is great. Okay. So last point that I really want to talk about is the evidence and research around screen time before bedtime, because this is a really, really common one, right? Especially now that, you know, so many households have multiple tablets and cell phones and devices of some kinds that for each and every one of their kids to use. And, you know, many of them are using them, you know, before bed. Let's talk specifically about what the research really shows in terms of the impact that that screen time can have on sleep. So
yes,
take it away.
So I did a post recently that I talked about how research shows that 65% of children are using screens in the 30 minutes before bed. So this is very common. And, you know, there is a lot of research really linking this to difficulty falling asleep, difficulty staying asleep, less sleep overall, increased tiredness during the day, nightmares. So there's a lot of sleep issues that are associated with screen time in the evening. And, you know, I think, you know, like we were talking about earlier, like we have to be realistic about this. Yeah. You know, some older kids need to be on screens for homework. Mm-hmm. Some of us who have multiple little kids, like you need your toddler to be safe while you're putting your baby to sleep. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I want to acknowledge the realities of that. And some of us feel like, well, I don't really have a choice.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are some people who, you know, maybe kind of have bought into the myth that screen time helps their child like calm down and wind down for the day. Mm-hmm. And that there doesn't seem to be any research supporting that, but, you know, I think there are ways we can kind of change our evening screen time, that could make it, less likely to disrupt sleep. First of all, I would say, you know, if possible, avoid screens in at least the hour before bed. Okay. If you have a young child here, like I need them to kind of stay safe and occupied for a little bit, you know, see if there's anything else that would work, like a calming podcast. My kids have one that they love called Storytime. You know, there are all sorts of like meditation apps out there for kids. And so see if there's anything else you can use to help your child calm down and keep them occupied during that time if you want. If you really feel like you can't, then, you know, be careful about the content is what I would suggest. So look for, you know, shows that are designed for children, and that are higher quality educational shows like, Dora the Explorer, because, you know, more, you know, this kind of scarier shows are more likely to lead to nightmares and anxiety, related to sleep.
Okay. Does the research differentiate between different types of screens? So for example, you know, watching TV within that hour before bed, where presumably the child is on the couch and the TV is, let's say, 10 feet away, versus being on a tablet where the child's sitting on a couch and the tablet's right in front of their face.
Yes, I haven't seen any research on looking at different devices. You know, I think if possible, you want to use a device where you can use a blue light filter. You know, there are also like blue light filter glasses. There's not a lot of research supporting those specific products, but I think it's worth a try. You know, it's one of those things that like, it doesn't hurt. And there is research showing that blue light from devices seems to impact children more than adults.
Mm-hmm.
So if possible, you know, try to block out the blue light. And it's hard to say if there's certain devices that are more or less likely to actually disrupt sleep.
Right. I feel like that needs to be researched a lot more because, again, my common sense, not backed up by any data whatsoever, but, you know, my common sense tells me that if I have a rambunctious three-year-old that I have to keep alive while I'm putting the baby to sleep, and, you know, a screen is like a guaranteed way to, you know, keep that three-year-old like calm and out of trouble, that putting him in front of, you know, the TV 10 feet away from his face is probably a lot more ideal than sticking him in front of a tablet, which is going to be right in front of his face.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be my sense too, but I don't have any data to back that. Yeah.
Okay. That's fine. You got to tell the powers that be that that needs to be researched next. And so when we talk specifically about, you know, eliminating screens before bed, the data shows that specifically the 60 minute period of time before bed is the most important time frame to have all screens off?
Yes. I mean, you know, as much as possible, you know, as far away from bed, you want to keep screens as far away from bedtime as possible. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you can do an hour, great. If you can do 30, you know, an hour is probably better than 30 minutes. But just keep, you know, try your best to keep the screens as far away from bedtime as possible. And something else in the research is having devices in your child's bedroom, mm-hmm. Maybe have a particularly negative impact. So if you have to do it, keep it outside of the bedroom because we want the bedroom to be associated with sleep.
And that doesn't surprise me at all, because I know that that's the general advice across the board for adult sleep hygiene is, you know, it's really not ideal to have a TV in your bedroom for that same reason, because, you know, you want your bedroom to be associated with sleep and winding down and relaxing. And if, you know, you have all these devices in your room, then, you know, you can end up like sort of subconsciously not associating your bedroom with just sleep, which can then make it harder for you to be able to fall asleep. So, you know, I know that when it comes to adults, that's, you know, well known. So it doesn't surprise me in the least bit that would be, you know, all the more important for kids who are that much more sensitive to these things.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Amazing. Kara, this has been so unbelievably helpful. I'm so happy that we were able to, you know, talk about these really hot button topics, not from a standpoint of philosophy or, you know, or tribalism or, you know, where you align yourself, but just plain and simple what the data says. I read this really great line. I can't remember who said it. I think it was somebody on Twitter that said that the plural of anecdote is anecdotes. It's not data.
Yeah, right? That's great. Yeah.
I figured that you would like that one. So, you know, in other words, just because there is a lot of people who say, oh, you got to do this or you got to do that or don't do this or don't do that because it can do X, Y, Z, remember that that's still not that for something to be considered data, it's not just a matter of, you know, speaking to a whole bunch of people telling you to do something. For something to be considered data, specifically to be considered high quality data, it takes a lot more than just speaking to people about their experiences. There's so much more to it for something to be, you know, published as a randomized controlled trial or, you know, or something of the sort. So that's what I specifically love talking about here, is not just, you know, a bunch of anecdotes or opinions, even though I did specifically give my opinions there, but I emphasize this is not based on data. This is just my opinion, my thoughts. But you know, the data that you've given my listeners here is huge regardless. So, where can people find you if they want more of you in their life?
Yeah. So I translate for research for parents and try to break it down into like easy, understandable tidbits through Instagram. And I'm at Parenting Translator on Instagram. And I have a newsletter on Substack, which is yeah, parentingtranslator.substack.com. I have a website, parentingtranslator.com. And, you know, my goal is just to get the research out there and kind of, you know, not only break down the research into easy to understand summaries, but also help to translate into what that actually means for your life while acknowledging all the realities like we've been talking about today.
Amazing. Fantastic. All right. So those will all be linked in the show notes. So you can go and easily find Kara if you want to follow her, get onto her newsletter. Her content is fantastic, guys. Like, really, you got to go check out her Instagram page. The free content that she gives there is honestly worth its weight in gold. Amazing. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. You all have a wonderful day. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with a friend who can benefit from it. I also love hearing from my listeners, so feel free to DM me on Instagram at mysleepingbaby or send me an email at eva@mysleepingbaby.com. Until next time, have a wonderful, restful night.